This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There's a trend at museums now, exhibits focusing on current issues, social problems, current events, and how they shape society. The Indiana State Museum decided to focus on the opioid epidemic for a new exhibit called Fix, Heartbreak and Hope Inside Our Opioid Crisis. And since our show is pre-taped today, we won't be able to get your questions to our panel of guests, but we would still love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me now is Brandon George, director of the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition. Thanks for joining us, Brandon.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your initial reaction when you heard about this exhibit being planned?
Well, honestly, my first reaction to it was I was taken back a little bit, and I was a little skeptical, if I'm being honest. I was with some state leadership, and the CEO, Kathy Furry, of the State Museum, was presenting on this exhibit that was going to happen. This was probably close to a year ago.
We'll have Kathy on later in the broadcast.
Great. She's amazing. But at that time, I thought, oh, great. What's the State Museum doing? We got all this money funneling into Indiana. Like, why are they trying to get engaged with the opioid crisis? How does it fit into anything? And so I was a skeptic at first. And then actually, I ended up talking to Kathy and her team afterwards. And I've done a complete 180. I'm really, really grateful to them and the time they've taken to really do something and do it right. One of the things I didn't realize at the beginning was that they were going to be hitting a completely different group of the community than the healthcare system does or my addictions advocacy group. These are going to be people that I don't normally interact with or a lot of people don't that are front lines with addiction, and give the ability to really get some good quality information about what's going on that's not from any particular lens.
Mm. Was your skepticism sort of this idea of nothing about us without us, just kind of the outside view talking about what your experience was or what others' experience are, and just sort of, I don't know, them trying to explain it having not lived through it? Is that part of it?
Absolutely. And there's been several groups, and unfortunately there's been a lot of poor media narrative around what's called the opioid epidemic, and I really don't like that term. I think we have an addiction crisis. Mm. There's this false narrative that all this was started just because a whole bunch of high school athletes broke their ankles and they got hooked on pain pills, and now they're IV drug users. And certainly that has happened before, but it's a very small percentage. And so I'm always concerned about what's the narrative going to be, and are they going to be able to do so objectively? It's really nuanced conversation, and somebody that's not really entrenched, it's hard to get every nook and cranny. And a year from that conversation of that skepticism, I couldn't be happier with how it turned out. They really were able to bring some tricky parts of substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, the history of it to the forefront to start some conversations that wouldn't otherwise take place.
Yeah, because it seems to me like part of the concern is that, you know, how could you get people to come to this? Because, you know, for some people, they don't understand it because it's not part of their lives. They don't know anyone who maybe has suffered from addiction. How are we going to get them to voluntarily go to an exhibit about something that on the face seems like a bit of a downer? But that's not how the exhibit was put together, as I understand.
Not at all. The exhibit's very interactive. I had an opportunity to go over there last week and walk through and see it. And it's really, really done well. A lot of education, a lot of conversation starters. You don't feel like you're walking through an exhibit that has had all the death that's been associated for the last, you know, 10 years almost. That's not the feeling. You don't walk through and feel like it's a memorial. And I think a lot of people were wondering that, you know, is this going to be how is it going to come off? And it couldn't be further from that. Like I said, they really do a good job of being interactive, a lot of stories of hope. There's not any gotcha moments in there to where there's startling photographs or anything that's just kind of catchy that you see a lot of times on television. And it talks about heartbreak and hope, and it makes sure it tells the story that recovery is possible.
Mm. And you are the director of the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition. And so how did you come to be in that position?
A lot of twists and turns, just like with everybody's life. And I'm in the position mainly as an advocate for those with substance use disorder. The Addictions Advocacy Group does a lot of things across the board, from legislation and public policy to education in communities, mainly letting people know that this isn't a moral failing. It's a chronic condition. And my why is that I'm a person in long-term recovery from severe substance use disorder and opioid use disorder. You know, my using started really early. Started paying consequences really immediately. And people say the reason I always touch on that is because that's kind of what the difference is in between somebody that may be experimenting and trying things out versus somebody that actually has a substance use disorder, that continued use despite negative consequence. Mm. And I paid a lot of them early. I was kicked out of multiple schools. I lost friends over drug deals. Was arrested multiple times for DUI. And so I had all these consequences piling up. But the inability to stop using and the inability to – essentially I'm walking up and putting my hand on a hot stove over and over and over again and taking all this pain and all these consequences. And luckily I was able to find recovery after several attempts or several rounds of treatment and have been in recovery for a little bit over the last 10 years. And I really believe that recovery is possible. I think that treatment works. And that's what my organization talks about in the community. Treatment works and recovery is possible.
And every recovery is different, right? Like some things work for some people that wouldn't work for others. What worked for you?
Well, a combination of things worked for me. And you're right. One of the things that we promote is what we call multiple pathways to recovery. And everybody's recovery is going to look different. You know, maybe some people do so because they have strong family support, strong faith. They get really involved in their local church. Other people may not be faith-based at all. And so maybe they lean into other community or dive into work. For me, it was a combination of evidence-based practices. I went to a residential treatment facility. It's where you go and you live there for a period of time, was in a structured environment, got cognitive behavioral therapy, which is an evidence-based therapy, medication for my opiate use disorder, as well as the social supports that we used to rely heavily on. So your 12-step programs, your Celebrate Recoveries, your Smart Recoveries, all these community-based supports that are offered. So it was a combination of a lot to get me there.
And so then what has your involvement been with the exhibit? When were you approached? And I guess how involved were you in kind of shaping what this is now when it just opened this past weekend?
Well, I've been involved probably for the better part of a year now. After I was at that meeting with the CEO, Kathy Free, part of her team had reached out and said, we really want to make sure that we do this the right way. We want to make sure that we don't cause anybody any pain. We want to make sure that the information we're putting out there is appropriate, and we want to make sure that we have community partners right next to us, hand in hand, as we put this exhibit together. And so I am really proud to have been involved in it. It wasn't just me. There was other organizations, Overdose Lifeline, Justin Phillips, their executive director, was a key part of this as well. But they had us engaged at every turn. Whether it was verbiage, making sure we're not using stigmatizing language, you know, we're really trying to get away from terms like addict and junkie and alcoholic and use first-person language, you know, person with substance use disorder, person with opioid use disorder. I used to think that was semantics, but it really, we've got data now that shows how much differently we treat people when we call them those negative terms versus the positive ones. And so the museum wanted to lean on the expertise of people in the community to make sure they got that type of stuff right.
The addiction crisis has been talked about a lot in recent years. What do you think about the way it's been talked about and I guess how the media has typically covered it? You kind of hit on that a little bit and sort of the use of the language has been a little off for some.
It's been really off. It's been hard to watch. And I know part of media is having people go to sites, it's having people watch videos, it's having people read stories. But overwhelmingly, it's been a shock and awe approach. Mm. And every time I turn on the news and I see a picture of a mother overdosed in the front seat of a car with a kid crying in the back seat, it just absolutely makes me cringe because it's not really telling a story of what's going on and certainly not a complete one. So I think that it has not been good at best. We're making some strides here. I know that the local media here in Indiana has done a good job of reaching out. We've approached some of them and said, hey, you know, we're really trying to avoid this language. It can help prevent people from reaching out for help. Stigma is a huge problem. I got a good friend of mine that always pushes back and says, you know, addiction is the problem, not stigma. But I just I think we've got multiple problems. And when people are so stigmatized that they're not willing to say, hey, I have a problem because of how it's portrayed in the media and everywhere else, the odds of them getting into treatment are very, very small.
Can you name, say, three things that you'd want people to either look out for or take away from the exhibit in the last couple minutes we have?
A couple things that really jumped out to me. One thing that we don't talk about enough, and some groups do, is how we are approaching this addiction crisis right now. Because this certainly isn't the first addiction crisis we have. You look at the crack cocaine epidemic of the 80s and how we responded to that, largely in a punitive measure with criminalizing all of it. It also affected our black and brown communities a lot more. And so we had a very punitive approach to that, threw a lot of people in jails, we wrecked a lot of families and communities, and now the problem is affecting different people, different socioeconomic status, a lot more mixed, a lot more Caucasian families, white families being affected. And the thought is that, you know, now we're treating it, now we're talking about treatment versus jail because of who the problem is affecting. And the exhibit puts that in our face. It talks about the crack cocaine epidemic. It talks about, have we learned our lesson from this? Are we going to treat this differently than we did back in the 80s around crack cocaine? And so I'm really proud of them for at least bringing that to a conversation starter. I also am really proud about the fact how much they talk about recovery. Anybody that goes through, they're going to get education on what opioids are, what they're not, who they're appropriate for, who they're not. It talks about the plight of chronic pain patients. We can't let the pendulum swing too far. Yes, we need to work on prescribing. Yes, we need to make sure there's not thousands of extra pills in our communities. But we can't restrict access so much that the people that really need opioids aren't getting them. And we found that in some cases. And again, this is something that's talked about in the exhibit. There's a good interactive thing there. I don't want to spoil it, but it lets people come to their own conclusions or gives them some good information on who would be a good candidate for them, who would not. And so those are a couple things off the top of my head that I think are really good pieces. And again, the hope piece for me is really what it's about.
Brandon George is the director of the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition and helped with a new exhibit on opioids at the Indiana State Museum. Thanks again for taking the time, Brandon.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll talk to two more people behind the exhibit to find out what they want visitors to take away from it. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a new exhibit at the Indiana State Museum about the opioid crisis. Today's show is pre-recorded, so unfortunately we can't get your questions and comments to our panel of guests, but as always, we would love to hear your thoughts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. We're joined now by two people who worked on this exhibit. Bethany Thomas is Vice President of Education, Programs, and Interns at the Indiana State Museum and Historic Sites. Thanks for coming in, Bethany.
Thank you for having us.
And Brian Mancuso is the museum's Vice President of Experience. Thanks to you, too, Brian.
Thank you.
Bethany, we're going to start with you. Can you explain what the museum's goal was with this particular exhibit? What do you want people to take away?
We really want people to be able to come in and help them to learn more about the opioid use disorder and the crisis that we're having here in Indiana. And we want to make sure that we're helping to reduce stigma. So having better understanding, better language that people are using to, again, break down those barriers to make sure that everyone's understanding the situation and really can come at it to understand it better, to be able to find ways that they can participate in the solution. So, again, just being able to go through the exhibit, learn some more about it, have those interactions, have those conversations. That's one of the things museums are known to be trustworthy, safe environments where you can bring up conversations like this, especially around hard topics like the opioid use disorder. So being able to have that ability through the museum and through the exhibits and programs that we do.
I hear that term a lot, breaking down barriers. I guess what kind of barriers are we talking about? Where I guess when we talk about barriers, we're talking about barriers to understanding, right?
Correct, right. And so, again, through the various components that we have through the exhibit, I mean, one of the great things about the exhibit, it is filled with science and history and art. So you're coming at different learning styles that people have, lots of personal stories, community stories that we incorporated in the exhibit. It's very hands-on and interactive, so different ways people can approach it and start where their starting points would be, and really to help, again, break down the barriers, help them understand what the crisis is, where we've been in the past, where we now. So there's just lots of different components like that. And also we want to make sure that they understand the hope behind the crisis through this exhibit as well, and that treatment is possible, recovery is possible, and there's lots of different solutions to the problem.
And all of those barriers to understanding kind of contribute to the stigma. What, I guess, mm-hmm. would you say are some of the most significant barriers where people are, I guess, most uninformed or misinformed?
So that's one of the things that we're trying to help establish through the content and the exhibit components is, again, the language. We really want to make sure that people understand how they're talking about this, how they view it, and so making sure that they have the words that they, you know, to be able to use when they're having conversations and break down the barriers that way, too.
One of the things that I noticed when I was kind of looking at the website that's put together for this is it really kind of struck me. The quote, "You're not dealing with a character defect. You're dealing with biology." And of course, we're talking about people who suffer from opioid use disorder. And it's all too easy to say this is a choice that they made and they need to live with it and things like that. And so what I imagine part of this exhibit is making people understand that it may have been a small choice at one time, but after that fact, it is not anymore. It's out of their hands.
And again, that's one of the main components that we're trying to get across in the exhibit, especially with our giant brain you can walk through to really talk about the brain chemistry, the neuroscience behind the disease. And so what's really happening, you know, inside your brain and what's going on in there that, like you said, is now creating this need, these cravings for the opioids, and then it's out of their control at some point. And so, but the good thing that this talks about as well in the brain is the fact that your brain can heal too. So there's even recovery through your brain and the science behind it too.
I want to get back to the brain, but I also want to bring Brian into the conversation. Brian, can you talk about the role that you played in getting this exhibit together?
So I'm head of the museum's exhibits department, and we really put all the sort of physical parts of this together, all the components that Bethany's really described well. We worked on, we did all the design work. The bright design is part of our department and our contribution to this. So we also worked with a lot of the community partners, and our staff went out to get personal stories. They went out to get community stories. And so really that conduit between content and visitor is where we sit.
And I understand the bright design was something that was very, very intentional, because it's really easy to look at this and think of it as kind of a downer. And why would I visit a museum, take a day off and go and see this, or go with my family and look at this? But what you're trying to focus on are you're educating, and you're trying to make this as positive as you can. And I guess in what ways is that being done?
Well, kind of intentionally throughout. So we looked at other things that play in the space of sort of substance use education in museum exhibits or in health centers, and we wanted to flip everything on its head. And so we really chose a brighter palette, a more open design, lighter woods, and even the architecture of the space is set up to communicate this progression from heartbreak to hope. We want people to really understand and empathize with where people are at in this crisis, but then move them towards recovery and really leave at recovery as possible. It's not it's not one of those museum exhibits that you go through and you have to see 1, 2, 3, 4 before you see 5, 6, 7, and 8. There's a lot of free choice learning in there. And, you know, Bethany mentioned that we want to start where people are at. And if you're really into art and that's how you're going to get a foothold in this, we want to offer you that experience. If you're into science, we want to grab you that way. And so we want to have this open plan. So there's just a lot of thought over the past 2 years of how we're going to get people interested in this. As you pointed out, you know, visiting museums is often a leisure activity, and we wanted to respect that from our visitors, but then hook them in and grab them and bring them close to this topic so that they can explore it from all sorts of different angles. And I think we were really successful in that. We were kind of, you know, saw the finished product, and it did what we wanted it to do. It feels open. It feels bright. It feels non-judgmental, that if you want to engage with this, you're not communicating to everyone anything. You're communicating that you want to explore, that you want to dig deeper, that you're just a curious person.
Yeah, there is something for everybody, it sounds like, no matter your sort of personality type. I want to talk about this interactive brain. Brian, since you kind of helped to design part of this, did you have a lot to do with that?
Yeah. My team is definitely in that process. We brought in some experts from the outside because none of us are neuroscientists. We're exhibit developers. So we're always having conversations with experts in the community. And in this brain, it's a large, I think it's about 14, 17 feet tall, fabric brain that you go into, and you're going to hear four movies about how your brain works and why that's important to this topic. Those chemical connections in your brain is where opioids and really any other substance gets that toehold in there. And it takes you through that sort of heartbreak to hope and leaves you on a sense of recovery. Inside the brain, there's also two other interactives that dig a little bit deeper and support those videos of those chemical connections and how your neurons talk to each other. So we really wanted to give people both a hands-on and media. There's a lot of things mixing with each other and to help with learning styles, to keep that interactivity and really spur conversations between our visitors. So that's what, at the end of the day, that's what we want, is we want everybody talking to each other in the experience, rather than just looking at an exhibit and going, yep, I saw that. Great. I saw that. Great. I saw that. And we've had some opening events and previews right now, and we're hearing that. We're hearing lots of people talking to each other about the thing in front of them.
Bethany, what I think is interesting about this and really positive is relating things that we all go through. If we don't suffer from opioid use disorder, we still have cravings for food or who knows what. If we're smokers, we have cravings for nicotine and things like that. It seems like a lot of effort was taken to compare the craving of opioids to those more common cravings, which are felt by most people. In what ways is that done in the exhibit?
That's right. We have an area where we have we're using technology, and we have something called a CraveBot. So you can kind of like a video game in a sense, where there's the controller and everything, and the little robots that you make sure that they're following a path. They're trying to get to a prize, but there's these little cravings that come after and pull the robot away from your path. Just like, you know, you're saying that we all have these cravings and sometimes pull us away from where we might need to be going. And so surrounded by that are examples of some of the things you even just mentioned, like nicotine and caffeine and social media. Even that today, you know, as soon as you hear that ping of your phone, everyone looks at it. You know, we're kind of programmed now to have that reaction. So it's helping to build some empathy around what we talk about on a daily basis and some of the same things that those in recovery and those fighting the disease are facing every day.
And is there anything to illustrate, I guess, the intensity of opioid use disorder and those cravings as they compare to things like, I mean, I you connected perfectly. Whenever I do see my phone light up, I got to look at it right away. I'm trying to break myself of that, especially when I'm around family or close friends and things like that. But it's hard to do. Is there something, Brian, in the exhibit that kind of, I guess, equates opioid use disorder with that or compares it to it to say opioid use disorder, the craving is so much stronger than this?
Well, we actually compare it. There's data out there that we've put into and actually linked in the big brain where there's a metric of dopamine that, you know, your daily amount is X. And if you see a food that you like or you crave food, and so that's a little bit more, and that's a little bit more, and that's a little bit more. And so we have that data in the exhibit for people to understand the power of these things. And that's one thing that we tried to build throughout, that with all of those other cravings, we're not saying that those are equal. We're saying that's a starting point. And we want you to understand that this other thing and other substances, frankly, are exceedingly powerful, and you're putting them in your body and the systems get overloaded and they become attuned to these new, very powerful substances. And so we want really people to think about that. You know, opioids are a powerful tool for pain management. But, you know, there are some risks involved. We want people to understand that. So the cravings are not one-to-one per se, but we use that as an entry point, as a building off point for people that might not have any perspective. Mm.
And Brian, you've worked on other exhibits before. You've worked on more, say, classic museum exhibits, which oftentimes you're talking about science, and we're talking about science here, or just sort of hard facts. And you know, and you worked very hard to take a positive look at this, or at least positive lining, I suppose. But what's different about building an exhibit around a current problem as opposed to building an exhibit around an historical timeline or something like that?
Well, I mean, that's just it, is we're not done with it. We're still in it. You know, it's a moving target. So current events exhibits are always a little they're always a little bit more difficult. It's always the extra challenge factor in that we're still – it's still evolving. And many things are. I mean, even things in the past are still impacting us today. So we always want to have that relevancy. This one, the relevancy is right up front. You know, if we look back at the Civil War, we can still talk about how relevant it is today, how much it still impacts our daily lives. But this is we're sitting in it. So to that end, we actually do a couple things in FIX. We have a couple historical touch points. We look at our last heroin epidemic, which was at the end of the Civil War. Mm. We look at the AIDS crisis. We look how we reacted to crack cocaine as a society and how we made some decisions, bad, good, neutral, that, you know, in those so that we're in this spot now. So we want people to really look back at some historical points and think about what we're doing today in relation to those. And I think that's another power of a museum, that we can provide that context, we can provide that history, so that you're not saying that this is a unique thing that's only happening right now. There's some precedent to it.
Is this a trend for exhibits to talk about more current things and have these exhibits that kind of target a current issue?
It's definitely for us. You know, the wider museums, the conferences I go to, it's talking about relevancy is right up there. That we want to remain relevant to people. We want to become a place or be a place where people can come and explore those topics and explore them in maybe a little bit more neutral or less charged environment, that they can come out with ideas of their own and say, you know, I was able to explore that thing. And one thing we did in FIX was to sort of dial it back to the basics. Let's understand what's happening in your brain. Let's understand how it's impacting people's lives and build from there so that when they go home that night or on the car ride home, they can have interesting discussions. Or when they go home and watch the news or listen to you guys, they can say, you know, I understand a little bit more behind that. Now I can consume this new thing. Mm. So they're kind of literate in the topic and they can consume new information as it comes at them.
Bethany, you are in charge of a lot of the – or rather in charge of the programs, I guess, with some of the historic sites, some of the off sites. As I understand it, there will be sort of satellite exhibits at some of those other sites around the state. Am I correct?
There's going to be there are different programming that we're going to do across this site.
Okay.
So, and that's working with a lot of the community partners in those where our locations are too. So really diving in to find out what their issue, you know, where they can address the issue. And so different programs we can do. We have a series called Courageous Conversations where we're bringing in real people, telling real stories so they can share their stories. We can have some experts who are, you know, facing this every day and involved in it and share those stories with others again so that they can, so visitors can learn a bit more. And so we're having courageous conversations at all 12 locations throughout the year and even beyond. So as long as this is an issue in our communities, we want to continue to have those conversations. And we're doing other different kinds of programs as well. Narcan, so getting trained on Narcan is something simple that anyone can do to help save a life. And so we're going to make sure that we have Narcan trainings available across our sites. And then again, just working with the communities and finding out the best ways to collaborate and work together. So again, to help the visitors at the sites and the community members at large to have these larger conversations.
So I guess in that way, will it be specific to that area, perhaps?
Yes, that's what we're trying to do, is making sure we're addressing what's really happening in these small,
in that
rural
particular community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. We started today's show with Brandon George from the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition, who is one of the people you collaborated with to make this happen. Who else did you collaborate with? How did those partnerships affect the exhibit?
Well, like Brian mentioned earlier, I mean, we've had over 50 community partners, probably even more at this point, because I think once you talk to somebody, they lead you to new people to talk to and have conversations with as well. So, I mean, we've dealt with some of the same community partners for the exhibit as well as through programming. Some are separate. But we just have, you know, we're lucky and fortunate to have such a community that stands behind finding solutions to this crisis. And so everyone's been coming up to us and really offering their assistance or their expertise or any different kinds of way that they can do that. And so, I mean, we've worked with lots of people across Indiana, too, that have that statewide impact. So many partners.
Brian, is there a particular aspect of the exhibit that when you were kind of putting everything together, there was, I don't know, I guess an aha moment? Oh, well, maybe we should do this. Or maybe you took an idea that's maybe being done elsewhere that was terrific.
You know, I think it was just the overall stance that we took. Mm. My background is actually in developing health exhibits for health museums. And so I wanted to flip that on its head. And the whole design that we created in-house was really in response to that. It was in response to how health information, how current health topics are consumed. And I think we could do something interesting with that. So not maybe one or two pieces. We definitely reached into our toolkit and pulled out everything for this one. We pulled it out, put it out there. But we really wanted to kind of change the narrative on how these things are done and how things are expected to be done.
We're talking about the new exhibit Fix at the Indiana State Museum on the opioid crisis with Bethany Thomas, Vice President of Education Programs and Interns at the Indiana State Museum and Historic Sites. Thank you, Bethany, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Brian Mancuso, the museum's Vice President of Experience. Thanks for coming on, Brian.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk to the CEO of the Indiana State Museum about the big ideas around this exhibit and how the role of museums might need to change in a world where information is so easy to find. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on a new opioid exhibit coming to the Indiana State Museum. We're joined now by Kathy Faree, President and CEO of the Indiana State Museum and Historic Sites. Thanks for coming in, Kathy.
Thank you very much. We appreciate all of your help with this.
Well, it's our pleasure. And it sounds like you were really kind of personally invested in making this exhibit happen. Why is this exhibit and what we're talking about important to you?
I believe that society has a tendency to make secret out of things that ultimately later we discover, had we only talked about it sooner. We could have solved a lot of things. If you look at the AIDS crisis, it took us a long time to sort of warm up to understanding what that was and come up with some better solutions. So we are in the middle of the opioid crisis. Everyone is working towards making a difference and figuring out solutions. And we believe that we're uniquely positioned to help shed light on the topic, to help people understand what's happening. Because without information, people make things up. Museums are a place where people trust what we say. So we are giving them an opportunity to have a conversation about something that is normally not discussed. It is something that is happening throughout society, throughout the country, throughout society. The Indiana State Museum and Historic Site is uniquely positioned statewide. We have sites across the state. So we have an opportunity to bring up a topic in 12 locations and help 12 communities start to think about what's happening and bring out some solutions rather than hearing just snippets about the terrible things that have been happening. A lot of hard work has gone into finding solutions, and we are trying to be a part of that solution.
I think it's interesting what you said, that without information, people make things up. I feel like that can be said about a number of different things nowadays. I mean, have you explored other ideas like this? Because normally, I mean, we've been talking about this on the show so far. Normally, when you think of museum exhibits, you're talking about history or science or something like that. This is a current social issue, current societal issue. Are there any other things that any other examples that you've seen in sort of the museum, I don't know, professional community that's like this, where you're tackling this current issue?
I think one thing that we're also tackling is the perception that museums are only about the past. Mm. Particularly our museum has been looked at as a history museum. But museums in general are really trying to be a place that are relevant. If you talk to a 10-year-old today, something that happened 50 years ago might be something in my childhood. That's not so long ago. So when you head back, everything after that's the, you know, the ice ages. So we are trying to really bring up things that are happening in people's lives today to be a resource to the communities that we're in and be a part of the solution to different social issues that we can help with. My colleagues at the Science Museum in Minnesota have an exhibition on mental health, another very important topic, another problem that society is having right now. And all of us are really trying to help do our part, not only to be a place where people learn, spend time together, socialize, but also to be a place where people can walk away and say, wow, I hadn't really thought of it that way. Or, wow, I really think I want to learn more about that brain science and that opioids exhibit. I had no idea the neurons operated that way. I'd like to go back and look at that. So we really look to be a catalyst, to be a place of conversation, to be a resource. And you will see museums will continue to be doing that moving forward into the future.
I think that one of the most important parts of this exhibit, at least it seems like from the face of it, and I haven't seen it yet, of course, is this idea of sort of building the empathy among people who may go and see it. Because I think that that is one of the biggest things that's missing for a lot of people, because there are a lot of people who have never been anywhere close to something like this, an addiction of this magnitude. And there's a lack of empathy on the part of a lot of people on the outside. And they think, well, this was a choice that you made and now you have to reckon with it. But there's something different at work here. And I guess how did you sort of illustrate that in a way that everyone could understand, from children to adults?
What we're really looking for, this is not for young children. This is actually for children 10 and above. Mm. This is not for the very young. We are doing some things to help younger children talk about their emotions and what's happening, but not this particular exhibit. What we know is that people were talking to us about what are real stories, what show me who's going through this. And what people will find amazingly is it is someone they know. It is someone next door. It is their aunt or their uncle. We are hard-pressed today in society to not have been affected in some way by the opioid crisis, whether that's economics, through the health system. But you would be amazed at how many people have said to us, my nephew died of an opioid overdose 3 months ago. I'm really glad someone's talking about it. It's been very hard on my family. Again, if we can have these conversations up front, give people a place to have them, information, but we're also trying to show people that this is just to be reckoned with. Like, let's talk about it. Let's deal with it. Any secret that's held has power over us. If we can recognize what this is and what it is, then we can use that power to move it forward and find solutions rather than allow it to control us.
And this exhibit's been in development for more than 2 years. Well, what happens behind the scenes to make an exhibit like this happen?
I've been in this business long enough that 2 years actually is pretty short for a museum, so I'm pretty proud of that. But what's interesting is, not unlike what we've been talking about, I spent the first year sort of breaking the stigma about museums, helping people understand that we do have a place in this conversation, that we can contribute, and that we can help make a difference. The number of people who were willing to talk to me, but it took a while for me as well to understand what our place was. I just knew we had one.
Stigma about museums. I guess I want to know more about that and why you felt you needed to kind of battle it, I suppose.
Not battle it, but really help people recognize that the past is very important and museums do that. We will continue to do that, but we can also do so much more.
You can be a part of a current conversation as opposed to just, hey, this is what happened or this is the way things are from, say, a science perspective.
Clearly. We also made sure that we went back in history and looked at other similar crises and how did we handle them. And maybe we can help people learn from them and move this crisis forward faster than we were able in other opportunities.
In putting together this exhibit, what can you compare the opioid crisis to historically when it comes to health crises?
There are two things. There was an opioid crisis after the Civil War that we talk about, and then the AIDS crisis really is the other time where there was a lot of misunderstanding, people frightened by it, and very shaming and an isolating disease. So we have taken learned from that, as well as looked at how other topics, race, things that have been topics people don't normally want to talk about, and how can we use the tools of a museum differently to encourage conversation and to build empathy around a topic that really could use the light shed on it.
Well, you talked about how quick it was that you kind of put this together. You say 2 years is pretty fast. I mean, and we're talking about something that's dynamic, that's changing every single day. So not only did you have the speed at which you had to assemble this, but also adapting along the way to maybe new information, new news stories. Oh, maybe we should put this in there. Was that a bit of a challenge? I'm sure
it always
is. Be clear,
the staff doesn't think this was quick, but that's easy for me to say. I'm not the one building it. They've done an incredible job. I really am excited for people to see it. What we're really doing is building a baseline for people. So, yes, science moves at an incredible rate of speed. We know that. Another reason why we chose a current topic, what's happened in the past 10 years compared to what happened the 50 years before that, is incredible. We all know that technology and science are moving at a rate of speed that none of us seem to be able to keep up with, but all of us are benefiting from. So we are really looking to start the conversation, to be a catalyst about this topic. Do we have all the answers? Absolutely not. Will there be things in this exhibit that are talked about that we will have to keep up with and have people live and do programming about so that we stay on top of it? Absolutely. But we do feel that it was important to have the conversation and that not having it was the mistake.
We're talking with Kathy Faree, president and CEO of the Indiana State Museum and Historic Sites, about a new exhibit on the opioid crisis, which is hitting the museum very, very soon and will be up for a year, correct?
Correct.
From this February to next February. And can you talk about the role that museums like the Indiana State Museum have played traditionally, and I guess whether you think that role might be changing? Are we still going to be seeing plenty of history and science, or do you see museums sort of moving toward closer to relating things to current events and having these kinds of exhibits?
The great news is yes, yes, and yes. We are not going to abandon things that we've done before, but it is really important, not like any other business, for us to stay relevant, to invite in new generations, to look for ways that we can make a difference in the communities that we live in, to be relevant to what's happening to the families who visit with us. So, yes, the Mastodon will be there. Fred, it's not going anywhere. but we will also be looking at other ways that we can help people understand what's happening in their world.
So the old standbys are not going anywhere, but we are working our way into sort of a bigger conversation about current issues and things like that.
Broadening our scope and our reach and our understanding of the role we can play in the communities that we serve. And again, as a 12-location system, we have an opportunity to bring informal learning, dialogue, conversations, building empathy into 12 locations that 11 of which may never set foot in Indianapolis, but they will have opportunities to bring their communities together around this topic and what's important to them. And we will be able to utilize and have been utilizing what we've learned from this exhibit and how we can take that out into the sites for topics and ask questions to see if those are things that could also be addressed in Newburgh or in Richmond or any of the other sites that we have.
And we've kind of touched on some of the other sites and what will be available this hour already. But to kind of recap, what will be an extension of this exhibit that you might see in Newburgh?
There will be conversations. We participate in the mayor's roundtable in Evansville. We've hosted a few events for them at our site. So we are also doing a program statewide called Courageous Conversations, which you've heard about. What's really important is that this is a learning lesson for us as well. The exhibit will be open for a year, but we will be working on this topic and working to be part of the solution well into who knows how long. I hope not forever. Let's hope that we are get a managed hand on it. But we are not getting into the subject and then jumping out. We are coming in, and programmatically we will continue to work within our communities to bring together topics and resources. If the justice system and the hospital and social workers and the schools all need to come together and talk about what's happening in their community, we would like to be the place to do that. We are non-threatening. We are inviting you to come in and ask questions, to be curious about what's happening without being questioned. And this topic is one that is particularly hard to have without people somewhat 30 or 40 seconds in thinking, oh, wow, I wonder what's going on with her, what's going on with her family. But in our environment, we're asking you to ask questions. We're inviting you to ask questions. So we are really looking at bringing that same safe environment statewide to all of the communities that we serve.
How significant was it for you to sort of have the governor's support behind this when this was he around making comments about this before it was even announced? Because it seems like he's very much in support of this.
Absolutely. Interestingly, it was one of the governor's five pillars last year and continues to be part of the health crisis this year. And we are a state museum. We're a quasi-organization. But you can imagine that this is important to the governor's office for the same reasons it's important to us. It is affecting Hoosiers across the state. This is something that all of us are being touched by. So he recognizes how important it is, and we recognize the role that we can play in supporting not only his work, but the work of the hospitals, the work of all of the counselors, the work of all the not-for-profits, everyone that is doing something to try and find solutions to this crisis. And we are just one piece of that.
Do we know if Governor Holcomb's planning a visit?
Governor Holcomb will be opening the exhibition with us on January 31st at the museum in the press conference. So, yes, he will be.
Perfect. And do you see museums, I mean, in your circles, have you seen them changing around the country and expectations around museums? We've kind of already touched this before, but I really kind of want to get a picture of the national trend, or whether there is a national trend of museums focusing more on current events.
What I think is really interesting is you don't have to go very far in Indianapolis to see museums doing dynamic, interesting, out-of-the-box thinking. We have two of largest museums in the country right here in Indianapolis, the Children's Museum and Newfields, both of whom have always and will continue to do very interesting and cutting-edge work. But yes, I am a part of a fellowship of 120 museum leaders around the world who have spent the past 7 years and each year in a fellowship talking about what is the role of a museum and what should we be doing and how do we go from nice to necessary. And for me, this is coming out of that, what can we do to be necessary and really contribute to people's world and help them understand just really how important a museum can be to your children's lives, to your families, and to your work life. Spending time in a creative area outside of where you are has proven to make you do better at work, where you've problem solved about things that you don't have to do. And then you can use those same skills for something you do need to do. So I believe, yes, museums across the world are trying to continue to move forward as society does. Again, there are things that we know are tried and true and will always be present that we know of. But it is also important for us, like society, to continue to move forward.
I like what you said about going from nice to necessary. I think that that's a good thing to shoot for. However, there are no shortage of people. And I think I fall into this spectrum as well, who don't really, they go to the museum as sort of a fun day, you know. And so when they go and they see something like this and they think, oh, I don't know if I'm going to go in there, that might just bring me down. How do you bring those people into this exhibit?
Well, perfectly example is that this exhibition is bright. We have four art piece installations within it. We have humanities. We have stories being told. We have data. We have brain science. So we have made sure that we have entry points for everyone. But if you look at the logo, it's pink. It's bright pink. It's light colors, again, shedding light. So we are not we are trying to help people better understand and to get information about something they don't have. But what we do know about health crisis and this type of thing in the past is that shaming doesn't work, nor scaring does not work. What really works is to help people understand, put in context, as you said, and also have them see people like themselves experiencing this so they can better empathize and recognize how it could potentially affect their lives too.
And you said as much in your blog post. You said this topic can be dark, but this museum isn't. And it's not about telling people, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not about telling people how bad it is. It's about saying, hey, we're in this, and here's how you can be informed and how you can help. And as you also said in the blog post, the primary goal of the exhibit is to reduce stigma.
Absolutely. And the only way to do that is to have people talking about it.
She is the president and CEO of the Indiana State Museum and Historic Sites, Kathy Faree. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you. We look forward to hosting everyone at the museum.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can get it anywhere you get your podcasts. And as always, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.